See if we can get through this basket. When a discrete awareness arises and passes away with respect to each mental image, sound, etc., should it be characterized as mindfulness, sankhara, aggregate, or consciousness, vijnana, aggregate? Are the mental images, sounds, etc., characterized as mind object consciousness, sound consciousness, etc.? What about when consciousness arises and passes away in turn by itself? Sounds like hard work. I think it's really helpful to come back to how Ajahn Chah encouraged in just saying, really, all knowing and letting go, knowing and letting go. And coming back to that as your ground, because once you start to figure everything out in its as separate and discrete events, then it becomes a bit complicated, and when there's just too much of you involved in it, and of course. That's going to lead to suffering. In a similar vein, to one of the Buddhist most central teachings of the Buddha on dependent origination and this causal links of the chain of phenomena and experience Ajahn Chah said, in terms of, when you're investigating that, you're trying to look at that sort of okay with the vijja as the causal condition and sankhara arises, sankhara. And he said, it's sort of like falling down from a tree. And he said, you don't actually have to count every branch as you're going down. You just have to know that when you hit the bottom, it's going to hurt. so that paying attention to the, where is the element of suffering, the dis-ease of the mind? Where is the cessation and freedom from that? And that's the more important question. It seems that having some Western psychological understanding or undergoing therapy can be helpful to a Buddhist practitioner. What are the dangers, drawbacks associated with integrating these different ways of working with the mind? I am probably similar to what I just said in terms of it's helpful when it helps to clarify the process of how one creates suffering and how one can relinquish suffering. And it's not helpful when it complicates it. Okay. When there is no movement in the mind, I think you referred to this as a cessation of dukkha. However, this spaciousness is impermanent. Is it thus not dukkha also? Well, there's a couple different things that one is can be also referring to in the sense of there's a dukkha as an experience and a dukkha as a characteristic, and so that those are two kind of different things. And then sometimes when there's no movement in the mind, that can be an experience of the that cessation of dukkha, and that arising of a quality of well-being and clarity. It can also mean that there's just no movement in the mind, and it might not be so clear. And the reality is that that is also impermanent, and as an experience, is, and especially when one has bemoans the fact of its change or is resisting its change, then that will foster an experience of dukkha, of suffering. And also that which is anything that is impermanent is also in terms of the characteristic of dukkha, in terms of fundamentally imperfect is maybe a good translation in that context as a characteristic. Can you speak to the relation between anatta and metta? While doing contemplation of the sense bases, the heart seems to strongly respond to offering metta in the space where there is no I or other. I think that is quite a good observation, and you recognize that experience of the self-dropping away, the kind of the agendas of the I, me, and mine are not there, the kind of the proclivities towards identification and position taking, that in itself is starting to actually, a natural result would be an experience of loving kindness, of metta, of compassion. It's a natural response of the heart. Once we get out of the way, then something rather beautiful actually happens. Is sati a sankhara khanda, thus part of the five khandas? Where does it originate? Sati is classified as a sankhara khanda, and it originates with volition and attention. Mm-hmm. So that one formulates a volition, one directs attention, sati is a natural result. What did the Buddha mean by delighting in seclusion? Was he not a people person? Well, people certainly liked hanging around him. I'm sure he was able to say his well-being was not dependent on having people around him. So that delighting, and there's many examples of where the Buddha just takes time away, and to me that's really interesting, that as a fully enlightened arahant, he would still take the time to go into solitude, because it's just natural that responsibilities, duty, contact, that has an effect. And to be able to delight in seclusion for a period of time as a kind of rejuvenating healing, in the same way stepping out of the world and being on a 10-day meditation retreat. I mean, you go back and the delighting in seclusion will there's a certain rejuvenating quality you can take back into the world. Ajahn Brahm says, stillness is bliss. All I feel is a peaceful calm. What gives? There's a couple things. One, Ajahn Brahm's a very good advertiser. I mean, it's his nature to be enthusiastic. And then, we'll all feel calm in different ways, and you know, and sometimes just the expectations that we have for a particular experience will start to it'll change it. So that if we're, you know, sitting there waiting for that bliss to come, it's already got a cramped field. Just being able to put everything down. Do you make a distinction between desire and clinging as the cause of dukkha? Clinging seems more manageable to me. Tanha will happen, will arise, but how I relate to this push and pull can maybe change with practice. But I think I'll say that we'll work with things as they are meaningful for ourselves, so that and it does, it changes. Different areas will look more interesting or attractive or make more sense at different times. And then also I'd actually also sort of thought, I should give a talk about clinging and attachment. That's right, I'm going to do that, and it never manifested. But a 10 day retreat. I mean, we talk a lot, but you can only say so much. So that you know, there are some things just never got around to explaining or speaking on as themes. But certainly that aspect of clinging is a really important habit, tendency, a quality that one needs to and it does in that sense of being manageable, in that you're starting to recognize more the object of where it's directed towards, whereas sort of the tanha is more an internal experience. So then, I mean, that's one way of putting it. But certainly with that upadana, then that clinging, grasping, attachment, one is seeing that what the object that is directed towards. So then one can start relinquishing around that. After 40 or so years of dedicating your life to the practice, is there anything about the quote-unquote Dhamma soup which makes you think, a bit more or less salt perhaps? Or is it the perfect soup? Yeah, with deepest gratitude for your dedication. I mean, there's always areas of practice, or in particular, you know, in terms of practice, you know, there's things of, would be really interesting to have more time to develop or focus around, areas of reflection and learning and study that I'd like to give more attention to. But in terms of the kind of the soup or the pool that's there of what we've inherited through the Buddha's teachings, then and how over the millennia people have practiced and experienced and left their examples, I think we're extraordinarily fortunate, and it's enough. It's certainly enough to be able to take and free oneself with. First, deep gratitude to you and the others in the Abhayagiri gang for holding this retreat space with so much wisdom and compassion. Your teaching is superb. Question: so many ways to focus the Dhamma lens. Do you ever recommend a systematic approach? That is, for this time, I will view experience through the three characteristics, four noble truths, or what have you. Or better to just let the mind see what it sees. It actually is important to take a themes and stick with it for some period of time, to both to steep oneself in that perspective, and then to start to draw out more of the nuances and clarity that one can that one would normally overlook. Because also, the habit of the mind is we just get inured to it or bored. We want the the new flavor, so that to be able to stick with a particular perspective for giving it a good shot, giving it a being consistent and steady with it, so that you get maybe a deeper perspective, and then you will get bored or inured to it, and they have to then give some space and sort of say, okay, what's actually what's there in the mix, and enjoy that for a while. Is there spirituality in Buddhism, or are we sense machines? One is that I guess there's maybe a specific connotation to spirituality, but certainly the whole function and purpose of the Buddha's teachings, as it has a transcendent purpose, right? It has a transcendent goal, so that mechanistic or materialistic kind of sense machine based perception is not really, you're using a particular framework to investigate so that we can help prod ourselves out of a habit of assumptions that keep leading us to down the path of suffering. So that is one's trying to find the balances so that we can relinquish that habit of ending up in a place of suffering. What is passed on during reincarnation? Well, one, the reincarnation would be the wrong word to use for Buddhism, in the sense of, just by the literal sense of the word, it's an actual something in this life is then reincarnated in another life, and that isn't how the process works in Buddhism. Rebirth is a good way to use the word, a bit more accurate, in the sense that it's even in this life we can see a birth and death of the experiences and mental states and volitions, and then there is even at death, then that what is passed on is the, say, like karmic imprints, the habits of the mind, the tendencies of repeated action, and they have a certain potency or pull towards it. So that's the karmic imprints are what are end up being passed on. Is there any sense that suffering and great joy go hand in hand? That is, love of kids, husband, wife, etc. I would reframe it in the sense of recognizing them as fundamentally different. Because sometimes in order to experience great joy, then you've got to be miserable other parts of one's life, or just because one's experiencing joy, then you sort of, okay, well, that's, I've got to make up for that by getting some suffering somehow. So it's sort of recognizing that you can actually separate them out, and one's relationship to the world, one's relationship to family, one's relationship to oneself, how to see it clearly so that there's a giving oneself the opportunity to experience that quality of joy without buying into the suffering aspect. There's a well-known Vipassana teacher whose interpretation of the teachings are such that one does indeed burn off or slough off past karma if it arises in the presence of awareness and equanimity, leading to a purification of the mind. Any thoughts on how this interpretation could arise from the teachings or commentaries? But I think it's more of a, it's sort of more of a Hindu and Jain teaching, that kind of perspective. But it's also there is a, on a certain level, there's a kind of a practical gist underlining in the sense of, you know, maybe trying to imbue some kind of importance, meaning, helpful function of that awareness and equanimity, and that seeing that it does lead to a purification of the mind. I think what it does do is it kind of conflates two things in terms of the karmic process as a goal, as opposed to in the sense that you need to burn your past karma up in order to purify the mind, but that's, I say, like an overextension, I think, of the logic in practice. Okay. Thank you for your generosity in teaching, the clarity of the teachings, and especially for your friendliness and good humor. Today I had the insight that rather than teaching us a metta concentration practice, you've been showing us how to have metta for ourselves in our practice. That makes me happy. Two booklist questions. Can you recommend a beginning Pali vocabulary book? Actually, Sudaso. Kind of beginning Pali vocabulary book?
One I'd recommend is, it's called Pali Buddhist Texts by Rune Johansson.
Oh, right, yeah.
Gives little short extracts of suttas, a full vocabulary list, so you can start to see the context and like read from a sutta with the full vocabulary for the Pali. It's very easy to get started on.
Rune, yeah. Rune, R-U-N-E, Johannesson. Yeah, it's been around for quite a long time. It's that's one of the things in terms of if I would have had more free time in my life, it would have been nice to learn some Pali. And then the other question, please spell the name of the author of the book you recommended, Eight Mindful Steps to Happiness. That is Bhante Gunaratana, B-H-A-N-T-E, and then Gunaratana, G-U-N-A-R-A-T-A-N-A, Gunaratana. Okay. If Ajahn Chah were to appear here tonight, what are a couple of questions you would ask him? Yeah, well, I mean, there's because it was many days ago when I said that. Would have something I missed regretted not asking questions. I think, you know, basically anything. It's just getting those questions going and just something, because we used to, you know, sometimes when we'd sit around and talk with him, you know, because it'd be just for him to start explaining and talking, and but particularly in ways of working with the mind and ways of perceiving attachment and relinquishment, and also, you know, different aspects of experience. Because he also, there's many things that he experienced, but he never really talked about or conveyed, because he didn't think it was particularly useful or necessary for practice. And, you know, some are, you know, just kind of, you know, maybe a bit frivolous. But it's still interesting, you know, in the sense of, remember one time, and he'd never talk about different beings and different planes of existence. It just, you know, it wasn't really a part of his teaching style. And then I was sitting with him one day, And a man came who was a student of his. He'd been practicing with him, and then when he a few years after that, when he retired, he was a railroad engineer, and when he retired, he came and ordained with Ajahn Chah. Good practice. Anyway, he had a question from Ajahn Chah. Nobody else was around, and he had a question about some particular ghost spirit that this person had experienced, and that had said that it came from Wotpaphong, came from Ajahn Chah's monastery. And so he asked, was that real? Was that true? And then Ajahn Chah sat down and said, oh yeah. And then he's told him where he lived in the monastery, who his friends were, who he was associated with, what his background was, and it's sort of this whole cast of characters that that lived at Wotpaphong. And then the person left, and then just right after that, this group of Thai people came. They showed up, and they asked, as oftentimes happens in conversation, is it true that devas really exist? Is it true that is there ghosts? And Ajahn Chah sort of looked at him and said, if I told you, would you believe me? And they said, oh yes, of course, Limpopo. He says, then you're really stupid. The Buddha never taught anybody to believe what somebody else said. And that was it. That was how we... So, that's kind of fascinating. And that's beyond, say, mine or most Westerners' experience. And just to know that there's this being able to view the world in a different way. There's also another time when Ajahn Chah went to visit his teacher, and he took a novice with him, and they were sitting and talking, and Ajahn Chah's teacher was getting pretty old then, and Ajahn Chah was, older, and then the novice was, he's kind of bored, and these two old guys sitting talking, and he's going to get you know, it's kind of drifting and nodding, and then he heard his teacher, Ajahn Chah's teacher, sort of ask Ajahn Chah, and how's your practice maybe the best way to say astral travel. How's that? Have you been working with that lately? And then, so Ajahn Chah started talking, explaining what he'd been doing, but it's something that there'd be no mention of that in his teaching or his, and if his teacher hadn't asked, then he would never have. You'd never hear about it. So that there's the possibilities of the mind. How to really hold really skillful concentration. How to investigate in ways, because then when somebody's developed their mind to that degree, then just the skills that have been. There's that maturity and experience in so many different facets that to be able to ask questions more about that, because it's so rare to come across a teacher who has that degree of skill, and of course never really asked, and never really thought to ask. If there is no self in the created and the uncreated, what gets reborn? I feel myself as not my body as I am walking. I don't know how to know that and experience and let go. As I mentioned before, the rebirth process is a karmic stream, and of course that is changing, in flux, impermanent, but it produces results. And the actual attentiveness to say one's experience as one's walking, just seeing the experience for what it is, seeing the sense contact, seeing the cognizing, the knowing, and just allowing that to be released, to be relinquished, to not proliferate, not make any more of it, not impose a sense of this is who I am. That in itself is what the catalyst that takes one to a real place of peace. Okay. What is the sound of one turkey clapping? Okay, so that was a little corny, and probably too high a vehicle for all of us anyway. The point is to thank you all for keeping such good humor in the mix. Humor is essential to the path, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And our practice is gets really dire when we're sort of, dead serious, and more the dead than the serious. So being able to not carry around things too heavy, making it too burdensome. Are there monasteries in this tradition in Thailand for women? Are women accepted at Wat Nong Bapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery? Yeah, at Ajahn Chah's monastery, there's about 40 or 50 nuns. It's about the same as the number of monks. There's about 40 or 50 nuns, 40 or 50 monks. And actually, the head nun at Wat Bapong from the very early days was Ajahn Chah's mother. So that was the dynamic duo. So that there are, and different monasteries will have facilities for, almost all the monasteries would have places for women to practice, and then there would be, some of the monasteries would have the nuns there that are living as a community. But also that, the northeast of Thailand is a very conservative area, very traditional, so that is pretty daunting for a Western woman. I'm not quite sure if I'm able to read this completely. Can you review and say slowly the words for becoming and annihilation? And did you mention a third? And can you review how to identify these? Probably in the reference to the talk this morning of the three types of desire, or tanha. So the first one being gama tanha, gama being sensuality, so sensual desire. And the second one being bhava tanha, which is the desire for being or becoming. And then vibhava tanha, being the desire for non-becoming or annihilation or pushing away. So that sense of course, sensual desire, that seeking gratification, seeking pleasurable experience for one's excitement, interest, that gratuitous kind of pleasure. And then bhava tanha, that for being, becoming, that sense of I, or wanting to stabilize, I want this to be like this, this is how I should be, or I want the world to be like this, sort of bhavatan, becoming. And of course have many nuances, and the we bhavatan have that pushing away of experience, I don't want it to be like this, non-becoming shouldn't be this way, those kinds of pushing, pulling, and grasping. So those are the ways that it manifests. And then lastly, can you review, anyway, it's about the seven factors of enlightenment. So I'm not 100% sure if I've read it correctly, but this is just a review of the seven factors of enlightenment. First one, sati, the mindfulness, dhamma vichaya, the investigation of dhamma, wirya, effort, joy, piety, pasati, which is tranquility, samadhi, which is that concentration or stability of mind, and the last one, equanimity, so upekha, being equanimity, equipoise. And can you talk about the last years of Ajahn Chah's life when he was so sick and couldn't talk? Do you think he chose to stay alive in that condition for so long? It was about 9 or 10 years that he was bedridden, and he so had to be looked after by the monks and nuns, and that kind of direct nursing of him was one. They actually built a special kind of hospital kuti, or hospital dwelling place for him, and there'd be 4 monks and 1 novice during the day and 4 monks and 1 novice at night. And every 2 weeks there'd be an opportunity to change. And then the nuns would prepare special food for him, and they'd bring that to him. So he was looked after in the monastery, in the community. There was also, he was officially a patient of the Queen of Thailand, so that the hospital sent a vehicle out every day with a doctor or nurse, and then they would come and check on Ajahn Chah, so that he got tremendous care. And 10 years of being bedridden, he never had a bed sore, which is, for those who have looked after people, that is an incredible accomplishment. Also, the monks who were looking after him, there would be a monk who had more experience, there'd be another experienced monk who was good enough, and then you could have 2 completely new monks, so that every 2 weeks there'd be a change or an opportunity to change, so that monks would come from the branch monasteries. They'd wait for, as on the full moon and new moon, there'd be a decision of who would be changing, so that you'd go several days before the full moon or the new moon, and you'd wait, and then you'd put yourself forward to be able to help look after Ajahn Chah. And any things that they did to Ajahn Chah, they had to practice on themselves before they could do it to Ajahn Chah. So whether it was massage or he used a nasal feeding tube in his later years for just liquid food, and the monks had to practice on each other and become very skilled on each other before they'd be allowed to do it with Ajahn Chah. And there was this tremendous sort of care that was given to him. One of the, Wat Pho Phong, as a, even when Ajahn Chah first became ill, Well, there would have been 100 branch monasteries already, so that very large community, very diverse, and to me it was a real kind of bodhisattva act on his part to be there, to provide the kind of core that held the community together, so that while he was still alive but not teaching or not giving guidance, then everybody had to figure out how to work together as a community, how to accept authority, how to take responsibility for leadership in that community. And what arose out of that has been a very coherent and well-trained and well-respected group of monasteries. There's probably over, nowadays there'd be way over 200 monasteries associated with Ajahn Chah. And without that, that period of Ajahn Chah, without him being there to give direct leadership, but him still being alive, was the catalyst for learning how to work together. And by the time he passed away, then I was in very much in the center of it, so that it's not on the human realm it wasn't bad. And there, it's a real group of diverse characters, and you think of the most monasteries. Once the great master passes away, within a few years, it's usually empty, and people have moved on to different places, haven't been able to get along with each other, or people just going off and doing their different, going their different ways, and it's quite ordinary, normal, but. Wat Bapong has been able to maintain this continuity. There's also a wonderful gift just to have, say, monks, men, doing that degree of nursing and really looking after every physical need of the teacher. It's a really tremendous gift to all of the monks. I've been taking a daily walk up a neighboring driveway, going past a vineyard with a lot of white sheep. There are also turkeys in one of the fields, at least until Wednesday. In one of the last... I didn't get it. I lead an innocent life. Sheltered. In one of the last pastures, there was an old horse and his companion, a black-legged sheep with a great mottled caramel coat and penetrating eyes. She really did have an inquisitive stillness in her gaze, definitely more present than the others down the road. Every day I'd walk past the field and expect I wouldn't see them together, and every day there they'd be, side by side, never very far from each other. Great companions, very comfortable, yet still an odd pair. I guess I feel somewhat similarly about this practice. Feels like an odd companion, yet really right at the same time. Maybe not always comfortable, but a good fit anyway. Today, those two walked up to the gate, and the horse let me pet him. Mrs. Sheep did not, but she did want to check out the action. My heart is full of gratitude for our Sangha, the fearless mountain folk, and the Dhamma. Thank you, thank you, thank you. That's very sweet. Upon news of her death, and even though she held no royal title at the time, Tony Blair called Diana the people's princess. Debbie, you are the people's Ajahn. Avabhaya Giri, thank you for the inspired Dhamma talk and blessing today, and for honoring Mary and all the women of the mountain. You don't know what it was like to try to get her out here. So. So, yes. It's good for her to get that feedback. Okay. This is just a sort of comment to the person who would like to remain sober, would like to recommend that he or she go to AA. It is helpful to go through this with other people. The book Buddhism and the 12 Steps might be useful as well. That's what's his name? Kevin. Kevin Griffith. No, Kevin. Ajahn, I'm so grateful that Ajahn Chah had the immeasurable wisdom to call you to teach. You are among the pioneers who braved the storms of culture shock to bring this beautiful Dhamma west, and now so many of us can and do benefit. May the tides of merit you created swell into a wave of compassion that will push your raft to the far shore, if it hasn't done so already. Thanks also to the whole Abhayagiri gang for continuing to be a strong field of wholesomeness in which us lay folks can find refuge amidst our striving to weave Dhamma into the world. Oh, soft, soft. That's the last one. That was... it's like a... it, very touching ending. It's true.